Governor Larry Roden calls for civility. We separate politics from policy as we kick off a new legislative session. From SDPB, today is Wednesday, January 14th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, a recap and analysis of Governor Roden's address to state legislators. Later in the hour, SDPB's Dakota Political Junkies ask what civility sounds like during session and during an election year. We also welcome Attorney General Marty Jackley and South Dakota Supreme Court Chief Justice Stephen Jensen. The Chief Justice brings a history lesson and an update into the work of our state courts. The Attorney General offers his legislative priorities, including attempts to stop information about medication abortions from crossing our borders. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
This is SDPB News. Governor Larry Roden gives his first State of the State address. Policy dominated Roden's speech. Governor Roden was introduced by his Lieutenant Governor Tony Venhuizen. Venhuizen kicked things off by asking the legislature to focus on sound decision-making and good policy over politics.
These seats are not ours, and this work is about governing. Whatever our backgrounds or viewpoints, all of us will be serving here together for the next 9 weeks. Let us commit ourselves to working together in the spirit of good government, in the spirit of good policy, to make South Dakota better.
Roden's remarks began with a similar sentiment. He preached the importance of convening as lawmakers, giving nods to legislative studies, governor-appointed task forces, and September's special session to vote on a prison.
I'm talking about convening because it's important for you all to understand my leadership style. I don't need to be the smartest man in the room. It's more important to me to get the right people in the room, people with different perspectives. We're focused on solution. Shortly after becoming governor, I pledged to all of you to a cornerstone of my administration, which would be civility. I believe we achieved that last year. So let's all recommit to civility this legislative session.
This comes during a session many believes politics could creep into. This year, all legislative seats are up for grabs during the November elections, and multiple lawmakers are vying for other positions at the local, state, and federal levels. With that has come endorsements from many in the legislature. Roden's address focused on many key topics lawmakers are expected to debate on over the next 3 months. That includes property taxes, which has caught headlines in recent years due to rising homeowner-occupied property tax rates. Roden pitched his plan to legislators, saying it's time for more substantial relief.
I propose that we cut owner-occupied taxes by giving the people of each county a simple option. Replace the county's share of property taxes with a half-cent sales tax. The people elected leaders at the county level could implement this plan if it fits their community, or they could refer it to a vote of the people, or the people could even initiate it. The areas with the biggest property tax increase are also those that attract the most visitors. So this proposal will allow those counties to cut property taxes and draw more revenues from tourists and out-of-staters.
Property taxes are expected to be one of the most contentious debates of the session. Republican Senate Majority Leader Jim Melhoff says there's a lot to discuss.
When you're talking about meaningful property tax, you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. I think the only way you get there is by reforming the way that we fund education and special education.
As of Tuesday, over 20 property tax proposals have been submitted to the Legislative Research Council's website. A majority of those came during a legislative task force on the subject this summer. Roden says he plans to host property tax town halls around South Dakota to hear from those affected. He says he's planned stints at the hardest hit areas, naming Sioux Falls, the Black Hills, and Clay, Turner, and Union counties. He extended the offer to all communities in the state. Roden also affirmed his support of the governor-controlled Future Fund and reinforced his stance on state-led economic development, a debated topic in last session.
Economic growth is a good thing, and we should encourage it. But growth should not be reckless. We should be bold enough to seize opportunity and wise enough to prepare for the future in a responsible way.
the Legislative Government Operations and Audit Committee pledged to support a bill that would rein in powers of the Future Fund by creating additional rules on it and requiring expenditures to be approved by the State Board of Economic Development. Roden also spoke on the Rural Health Transformation Plan. The state was awarded $189 million in federal funding next year for its plan. He says it fits South Dakota.
This plan was built with extensive input from rural communities, the Great Plains Tribal Leaders Health Board, and the health care providers and other stakeholders from across the state. They told us what they need, and this plan delivers it. South Dakota is competing with every other state, and in future years, the federal government will reward states that move quickly on this. We could be the first state in the nation to authorize this funding.
Roden told the chamber he would love it if this bill was the first to reach his desk for a signature. He also says he plans to draft a bill cracking down on mail-order abortion medicines. Sioux Falls Democrat Kaden Whitman says there's a strong appetite for more conversations on the abortion debate.
I think more than anything, my reaction was disappointment that the governor would use such blatant misinformation and mistruths around abortion medication in South Dakota. If there is an appetite for a conversation around it in South Dakota, I'm hopeful that we'll see it this year.
South Dakota's legislative session runs through mid-March. SDPB will provide coverage of every committee hearing and House and Senate floors for the entire session through journalism and live streams found at sdpb.org/sdnetwork. I'm SDPB's Jackson Dirks.
Politics and Public Policy Reporting is supported by the Center for Western Studies at Augustana University.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're broadcasting live today from the SDPB studios in Sioux Falls and in Pierre. The federal government recently awarded South Dakota $189 million for the first year of the Rural Health Transformation Program. But time is of the essence to prove it is money well spent. SDPB's Jackie Hendry is in Pierre. Jackie, what are we talking about here?
Hi, Lori. So the Rural Health Transformation Program was included in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which was signed into federal law this past summer. Listeners may remember. State officials and the Department of Health put together South Dakota's proposal. Just 2 weeks ago, South Dakota found out it was awarded $189.4 million for fiscal year 2026. Now, this is a five-year federal program, so additional awards will depend on how we use the first one, as Governor Roden noted in his State of the State address yesterday. However, it's up to lawmakers to approve the spending authority, which is why the governor said he hoped that would be one of the first bills to cross his desk to get the ball rolling.
So how are lawmakers responding?
Most of what I've heard so far is that lawmakers just want to know more. I spoke to House Majority Leader Scott Odenbach after yesterday's address. He said this is an issue that may have caught many lawmakers by surprise.
And so I think we need to do a good job as a legislative branch to make sure we understand what the guardrails are that are coming down from the federal government on that spending, and that it does benefit all the rural areas in South Dakota especially. And I think we also ought to work closely with our tribal leaders to address so many of the issues that we hear, pressing issues year after year in Indian country. Maybe this presents a good opportunity to leverage some of that money for not just spending now, but maybe some long-term changes.
So, Lori, the governor mentioned the state did hold some town halls or listening sessions as it was compiling its proposal, which included input from tribal health experts. But again, based on those remarks, it sounds like lawmakers just really would like some more reassurance of how we got here. Mm-hmm. And I should also mention that we're talking less than an hour before the State of the Tribes address. So it is possible we could hear a little bit more about how tribes were involved in this programming further.
All right, Jackie, help us understand what the overall timeline is here.
So based on a very recent story from KFF Health News, states have until January 30th to resubmit their budgets to the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. That's the federal branch that is really overseeing this program. CMS then has 30 days from when they receive the state's budget to respond. By this summer, states have to present how the initial funds are being spent, and then federal officials will announce next year's funds by the end of October. So that's a very, very short timeline. Because next year's funding is on the line, there is a sense of urgency from the state in documenting that progress. But again, they'll need to get lawmakers on board as soon as possible.
And there is a lot of work to be done. Jackie Hendry, thank you so much for the update.
Thanks, Lori.
You can find Jackie Hendry's reporting this legislative session online at sdpb.org. South Dakota Supreme Court Chief Justice Stephen Jensen gave his annual State of the Judiciary address this morning in Pierre. The report included updates on indigent legal services, the pretrial services pilot program, and implementation of a 2025 bill that changed how ingestion of controlled substances is prosecuted in South Dakota. And the speech also included a history lesson about state courts and about America. The Chief Justice is joining us now from SCPB Studios in the State Capitol Building in Pierre. Chief Justice Jensen, welcome back to In the Moment. Thank you for making time.
Thanks, Lori. It's always great to be here.
I was really taken with the beginning of your speech before we get into all the details of what's going on in the state court system. You wanted to remind people about an important part of how our legal system was formed. Will you tell listeners a little bit about the Boston Massacre and a famous attorney who stepped in to do a really hard job?
Yeah, so our second president, John Adams, essentially defended eight British soldiers and the captain who were charged with murder. And in the course of the trials, the evidence showed that there were two of the British soldiers that had fired on the crowd, but the rest had not. And the captain was uninvolved in terms of firing on the crowd, and so the jury found a number of the soldiers not guilty along with the captain. And John Adams is here representing these redcoats, and a few years later, he's writing the Declaration of Independence saying, we want to be independent from you guys.
Yeah, fascinating stuff, and a good history lesson to kick off. 97% of cases tried in the United States are tried in state courts, you said.
Right.
Yeah. All right, let's talk a little bit about progress from last legislative session. Begin with indigent legal services. Where have we made progress, and where is the work left to be done?
Yeah, so we have moved into the appellate side so that we have services available for all appeals in South Dakota. Where we want to move next is to the trial court level. That's much more complicated. We have courts across the state. There's going to be a need to figure out where we place attorneys, how we get them involved in cases, how judges assign them. And, of course, there's going to have to be money to authorize the ability to do that. Right now, counties are paying for all of that. And I think a part of the thought is that if we can shift some of that responsibility to the state and also have full-time attorneys who are doing this work, we'll have a lot more experience and expertise in these cases, particularly the more serious felonies. And so we have really made big progress on the appellate side, but a lot of work to do on the trial court side.
What's at stake here for justice for everyday South Dakotans in criminal court?
Yeah, I as I mentioned in my speech, I hear from judges all the time. We don't have enough lawyers who are experienced trying cases to defend these cases. Part of it's a matter of compensation, but a lot of it is we don't try as many cases as we used to in the court system, and so a lot of young lawyers have not had an opportunity to try felony cases, and you get in the more serious felony cases, you want someone experienced who is able to anticipate issues and raise the appropriate issues at the time of trial. So a lot of this effort is really getting more experienced, having more training and assistance for younger lawyers so they can get to the place where they're ready to try the types of cases that they may see in the more serious felonies.
What are you asking for from the state legislature this year regarding indigent legal services?
So as I told them, we're not asking for any appropriation this year. This year we really see as a two-phase. One is really solidifying the appellate system that we have in place. They have attorneys hired. They're arguing the cases, making sure that they have a good process in place. And then the other part of it is really planning for the future in the trial courts and thinking about how best to implement this. Do we have regional offices? Do we have all the attorneys located in Pierre or Rapid City or Sioux Falls or a split? How would we set those offices up and how best to use them so that they're efficient? And then, of course, there's going to have to be the policy decisions, which I'm going to be less involved in.
Yeah.
Who's going to fund that? Is it going to be the county or the state?
You also said in your speech that recidivism rates matter, and you have seen across state court, across the system, an increase in juvenile gun and gun violence cases. Looking for better outcomes in juvenile probation, what are some of the questions that all this brings up for you?
Yeah, there's a lot there. We don't have this is the solution. We don't have the magic mm-hmm. pill to address some of these issues between mental health, substance abuse, some of the lack of family structure. Those things really complicate our ability to manage and supervise these young people on probation. But one of the things we're doing is we are really recommitting on an internal basis to try to think about how we can better address the younger people in our system and better address their needs, both on the juvenile side and also young adults, 18 to 25 year old age, because in some respects, those groups both share a lot in terms of some of their brain development and maturity, things like that, that we think we need to and can do a better job of supervision. So that's an area we're working on. And then, of course, services is always a significant issue to make sure that we have the services we need. Mental health services mm-hmm. are a huge demand right now and a huge need for young people. That's a real struggle for us.
Yeah. Last year, Senate Bill 83 redefined ingestion crimes in the state with some caveats. Tell me a little bit about the implementation of Senate Bill 83. Remind people what is happening here and how is it rolling out?
Yeah, so Senate 83 took ingestion of a controlled substance. Prior to 83, it was a felony offense, the first offense. Now the first two offenses are misdemeanor offenses. As a court system, we've never supervised misdemeanants on probation. So we've adjusted our system so that we can begin supervising misdemeanor offenses because the legislature is requiring that as a part of Senate Bill 83. So we are now in that process and have that in place so we can supervise misdemeanor offenders, make sure they get a substance abuse evaluation, treatment if necessary, and then follow-up supervision from the court system. So that's one change. We're also working on, particularly in rural areas, what we call HOPE probation, which is a structured program where individuals are regularly tested. And hopefully before they get deeper into the system, we can catch individuals who maybe are starting to use and discourage them from using by having swift sanctions. And then also using treatment as a part of the rehabilitation process. So it's really a two-part process. But all of those things are things that we're currently in process of working through and developing. I don't know what will come out of this year's session in terms of any modifications or changes to 83, but we'll continue to work on the process of what we have right now in the current legislation and the current law.
So much of the work over the summer, Chief Justice Jensen, in the legislature was about the prison and rehabilitation, looking at recidivism rates. So we've talked a lot about that. And in your address, you talked about the expansion of treatment courts, how impactful they are in people's lives. You invited legislators to learn more about them this session, in fact, this month. Help the general public understand the importance of these treatment courts, especially as we all consider the cost of a new state prison for men.
Yeah, the treatment courts are really a very intensive structured program. It's the most intensive program we have, which also means it's more expensive. It's about $8,000 a year for an individual that goes through a treatment court in South Dakota. That's about what the cost is. That offsets, however, if that individual was placed in the penitentiary, it would be $33,000. So there's a significant savings. And there's also an opportunity to rehab that person. They get treatment services. They get intensive supervision, which we can't do in every case because we just don't have the resources to do that. But for individuals that are struggling with addiction issues, mental health issues, we're able to provide that structured environment. There's a lot of services brought in for them. And we've had a lot of success. I mentioned today in my speech that we watch those individuals for 5 years after they graduate or from the time they start the program. And the success rate on those is that 73% have not reoffended in the 5 years. And that tells us that most of those people are probably not going to reoffend if within 5 years they've not done so. So those, when I first heard those numbers, we worked on those this fall, I was amazed. I'm like, wow, that's incredible, because that's this is the most difficult group of probationers we work with. So we're really excited about those numbers and really hopeful that we can continue that.
And momentum. a significant cost savings compared to penitentiary.
Right.
Yeah. Do you want to, we have, of course, the entire speech available on SDPB's website if people want to listen to the whole speech or read the transcript of it. Before we let you go, I'm wondering if you want to say something about Justice Jeanine Kern.
Yeah, Justice Kern was a colleague for 11 years, or a member of the court for 11 years, and I was her colleague for 8. wonderful person. She is such a hard worker, dedicated, really cares about the people that come into the system, and really cared about the integrity of our system. And so, it's hard to say goodbye to her, but Justice Kaczynski Robert Kaczynski is our new justice on the court that's replaced Justice Kern. Fantastic, and I don't think we're going to miss a beat with Justice Kaczynski. So it's a transition, and it's always hard to say goodbye to a good friend, but we think we're ready to continue and be up and running.
Well, we thank you so much for stopping by with a brief recap of the full address. Again, we'll put the full address and the transcript on our website at sdpb.org. Chief Justice Stephen Jensen with the South Dakota Supreme Court, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lori. Appreciate the opportunity.
We have analysis of the Governor's State of the State Address later in this hour. But first, South Dakota's Attorney General steps up to the mic. We'll explore his legislative priorities, and that includes a deeper understanding of medication abortion in South Dakota. It's all coming up after a break. You're on listener-supported SDPB. Welcome back to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We are broadcasting live today from the SDPB studios in Sioux Falls and in Pierre. Later in this hour, we welcome Dakota political junkies John Hunter and Michael Card for analysis of Governor Larry Roden's State of the State Address. But first, South Dakota Attorney General Marty Jackley joins us with a look at his annual legislative priorities, and he is joining us from Pierre. Welcome, Attorney General.
Thank you for having me.
Let's get started with helping listeners understand how you establish this legislative package every year. What is the process throughout the year to get to the first day of session?
You know, the process is one of meeting with stakeholders. It may be meeting with an open meeting commission about what we need to do for transparency. It's certainly working with the sheriffs, the chiefs, the state's attorneys in going through what we've seen over the year, how we can better protect South Dakota. And then, you know, talking to legislators about what they would like to see for public safety and moving things forward, and then getting the drafting done, and then showing drafts to committee members so that we can move the process along. I mean, South Dakota only has a 40-day session, and so we've got a lot of work to do in those 40 days.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about some of the bills that you have filed or are getting ready to file. There's quite a list here.
We're bringing 10 bills. We're ranging from public safety to election integrity to open government transparency. When I break the bills down, the 6 of them that deal with public safety are very important to law enforcement. I'll have an opportunity to be in front of judiciary tomorrow morning on those bills. They One of them protects kids. One of the experiences we had in South Dakota with the vape shops, we did an operation statewide. As we looked at five vape shops, every one of them failed. There was illegal activity going on. But one of the big concerns were that we don't have age limitations for some of these dangerous chemicals that are coming from China. And we felt they're being packaged and marketed to young kids, that we need to put some protections in place. We have them for alcohol, tobacco, other drugs, that we need to have an age limitation. So that's one of them. And then, of course, we've seen an influx of drugs into our penitentiary system. Mm-hmm. We have about 117 pending cases right now. We've seen 8 overdose deaths since February. We've indictments on a variety of different inmates, former correction officers, nurses' aides, citizens bringing drugs in. So I felt as both a deterrent and an accountability, we need to have stronger legislation. So we're bringing that legislation. And then just a couple of other areas that we've seen from cases, AI. I'm a big promoter of AI as an electrical engineer. I think it can do great things. I agree with the president that we need to have a national policy, but until we get that from Congress, the state needs to protect its citizens. And we've done that with the creation of child porn with AI, where they're taking our kids' pictures off social media and putting it in pornography. And I'm asking the legislature, based upon a recent case, we need to protect adults from that too. Having the bad actors take your picture off social media or take a video of you and literally plugging you into pornography, that's just wrong, and we need to put some protections in place.
Let's talk more about that. Tell me a little bit about how you implement that and enforce it. What are you looking for here? This is Senate Bill 41, yeah?
Yeah, and okay. So the enforcement's pretty easy. We came across it in a recent case. I have to be a little careful because it's pending, but mm-hmm. It was the driver's license case up in Aberdeen, where the allegations are an individual was taking information from the driver's license registration process. You get pictures, you've got social security numbers, you have addresses, a lot of private information. And we had a cyber tip, which is a tip that comes from legitimate businesses from their platforms. This one was from Microsoft, it can be from Meta, Facebook, but there'll be an indication that we've red flagged something is illegal or dangerous, and they give that to law enforcement. And as we come across these pictures, an example would be is if you came across somebody's driver's license and then also in the investigation you came across that individual from the driver's license picture in pornography, then, that's evidence that the crime has been committed. You contact the victim and, ask whether you consented to this, were you aware of this? Mm-hmm. And, in that particular case, there's over 50 victims. And so these cases are fairly easily enforced because of the partnerships and the cooperations that we have with good businesses that have the platforms. They don't want these people doing illegal activity or harming people on their platforms. And they look at law enforcement as part of the solution when they find it of how to address it.
Thank you for that. Governor Roden said in his State of the State address that the two of you were working together to, quote, stop abortion pills from coming into South Dakota. Tell me a little bit about what kind of legislation you are looking at with the governor.
Sure. We're doing a couple of different things. Earlier this session, the governor had sent a letter to me asking me to address and investigate the illegal activity of advertisements that were occurring, deceptive advertisements, and the sale of certain pills in South Dakota. We're doing that. In fact, it's the Mayday case that is set for hearing this Friday at 9 o'clock. They've also sued us in New York. We're addressing that. So there's the what I would call the cease and desist that I did as Attorney General and the litigation on the injunction. And then the governor and I have had meetings and our teams are meeting to look at how we can strengthen South Dakota laws. We always want to make sure we don't have unintended consequences, but then we want to make sure we're best protecting our citizens. So there'll be some legislation that I think you're going to see both of us advocating that it makes sense, it better protects South Dakota, and I think it protects the intent of what the legislature has said before.
So the Mayday Health countersuit, if that's the right term here, legally, is saying it's legal for us under the First Amendment to provide information about things that are available to people. Yeah, what is your response? Is this, I mean, obviously, we're going to watch this play out in the courts, but help South Dakotans understand the legal argument for saying, no, this is not protected speech. How do you see that?
The United States Supreme Court has said deceptive and illegal speech is not protected by the First Amendment. I'll use probably the best example is if somebody truly believes that methamphetamine ought to be legal, they can do a billboard that says we should legalize methamphetamine. I don't agree with that, but they have a First Amendment right to be able to do that. But what they can't do is put up a billboard and say, I'm selling methamphetamine, come here to purchase it. That's criminal solicitation. And that's exactly what Mayday has done. They have indicated we're going to target South Dakota, and they've done that. They said we put 30 different advertisements up. We live in a state where gas stations didn't like that. I was flooded with phone calls and letters with legitimate businesses saying, we never agreed to this. We don't want this. They won't take it down. I did a cease and desist. They've now taken all down but two because they want the legal challenge, which I guess that's their legal right, but they don't have a legal right to be deceptive in South Dakota. They don't have a legal right to violate our laws. And I really don't believe a federal court in New York should be deciding what our laws are. And you know, our legislature and our governor decide that. You've already heard from the governor on his position on this. And then I, as attorney general, enforce that. And I have a feeling that we will have a hearing on Friday, and it should take care of many of these issues. And then I literally this morning just filled out my paperwork to be a member of the federal bar up in North New York, and I'll go address that. But certainly I'm going to stay focused here in South Dakota on getting those signs down that are advertising deceptive activity.
What's the deception? I understand the legal activity in South Dakota based on our laws. That would be one thing, but what's the deceptive nature of these ads?
The deceptive nature is a couple of different things. Number one, it's being deceptive on that it's legal here. You can't, you know, we have a statute that says it's criminal to mail and to utilize those pills. It's not illegal for a pregnant mother to use those. The legislature was very careful to say, you know, we don't want a pregnant mother that was to utilize one of these pills that has a medical reaction to not seek medical treatment. And that's the basis why the statute's built upon to charge the company that's sending the pills in, the person that's administering the abortion process. And so that's deceptive. The other part is, I consider this deceptive, telling a young mother that if you take these pills you purchase through this process and you have an adverse medical situation, don't seek medical attention. They go so far as to say, because you'll be prosecuted. You won't be prosecuted. You should seek medical attention. And I've always encouraged, you know, there's better ways to do this, adoption and otherwise, but if you've made that decision to do it and you have a medical circumstance arise from doing that, for heaven's sakes, seek medical attention. We want to do everything we can do to protect you as well as that baby.
We will be tuned in to how that plays out in court. South Dakota Attorney General Marty Jackley. Lots more to talk about as the session proceeds, but for today, thank you for the preview.
Thank you so much, Lori.
We will take a quick break. The Dakota Political Junkies are next. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We are broadcasting live this hour with recap and analysis of the kickoff of the South Dakota State Legislative Session. Let's round out our hour now with expert analysis from our Dakota political junkies. John Hunter is publisher emeritus of the Madison Daily Leader. He is a member of the South Dakota Newspaper Hall of Fame. Michael Card is professor emeritus of political science at the University of South Dakota in Vermilion. And they are both seated here at the Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. John Hunter, welcome back.
Thanks, Lori.
Thanks for driving in. Same thing, Mike Card.
I'm glad to be here.
I appreciate it. All right, let's go back to Governor Larry Roden's State of the State address and talk about some key takeaways. What were you keyed into to kick us off with? Mike, why don't you start?
Well, I think the first thing that you mentioned earlier in the hour was Tony Van Huysen's call for civility, noting that we have 105 citizen legislators, and they each have constituencies, and they each have their own wishes and desires, and then Jackie Hendry noted that for them, there's Well, what was it? She spoke with the Senate Majority Leader, who noted that these may be wildcats as opposed to just legislators that need herding. And I think that's the place to start here. And there's a variety of things within the governor's speech. And I think that's probably time to talk with them about those, especially under that guise of we need some civility. There's, as you noted in yesterday's In the Moment program, we have a lot of conflict, and we have social media, which is raising the conflict. And whenever we get upset, we sort of lose our minds.
John Hunter, what did that moment with, especially with Lieutenant Governor Van Huysen, before they even introduced the governor, giving probably a minute or so over to why we're here and civility?
I think Governor Roden is demonstrating more civility than his predecessor. And when I say demonstrating, I think it's, you know, we've talked in the past of how do you define civility. But what I think he's meeting people, he's open, he says, you know where to find me. He's, I think, giving much more respect to the legislative branch than some other governors have. And saying, look, let's wait together. We talked about his property tax proposal. He said, look, this doesn't have to be the only one. I'm open to others. Let's discuss this. You know, we talked at the budget address. He said, here's some money if you guys want to work with this. And right. I just think he's demonstrating the kind of things that we'd look for in a civil kind of conversation. But that's no guarantee. There's a lot of people in peer, you know, 105 legislators, department heads, cabinet people, the governor.
And issues that people are passionate about.
Yes.
And it's an election year. So what are we listening for as the year goes on about who are the people, Mike Card, from a political science lens, you can send out to say the tougher thing, and who are the people that have, like, what does civility sound like when you're also in the rough and tumble primary season, pre-primary season?
Well, we are in the pre-primary season, so I think we'll be on the lookout for what bills get sent to committee in the House. Mm-hmm. The Speaker of the House, John Hanson, is one of the candidates for governor, and the Speaker of the House determines which committee bills are assigned to and works with the majority and minority leaders as to which members of the House of Representatives sit on those committees. And we know that even last year there was a little bit of confusion, I'll say, maybe that's the nice word, about why certain bills were sent to certain committees. This isn't new. This has always been the case that the Speaker and the President pro tem of the Senate will send bills to committees to deal with them as they see appropriate based on their conversations with the governor, with their caucus and the like. Yeah. So I think that's one of the first things we'll look for. Will taxation bills go to the taxation committee? Just as one example.
All right. What else stood out for you, John Hunter? What's another big area? We talked a little bit about civility and this idea of convening and getting together and talking things out in South Dakota. And then you noticed what that the governor said.
Well, I was struck by, you know, we've been talking about property tax relief, or a lot of politicians have been talking about it. And so he made a proposal, which I think was interesting. And it's not a poorly thought out proposal, but it is swapping one tax for another. So it is neither.
It's simple.
It is
understandable.
Simple. Yeah, I think so. So it, in addition,
fits on a bumper sticker.
So I think that'll be interesting to see how that plays out. There's, you know, it's not perfect, and again, it's swapping one tax for another. So I guess the good news is that it wouldn't involve, you know, huge cuts to school budgets, which some other property tax proposals have said. This is – and it's a fairly small shift, but I don't mind small shifts. And same with the homeowner thing that was passed last session. That's just a step in the right direction. So there's no reason – if you do think your state is in good shape, why not to – don't make – proposals that throw the fabric completely into disarray.
Seth Tupper said on our the most recent Junkies conversation he was a part of that a lot of people forgot about that property tax legislation last year. I had forgotten about it until he said it, and now Governor Roden is reminding us, this is what I did last year, this is what I'm doing this year, you're welcome to be part of the conversation. Yeah. It's fairly well played.
And I think it's very well played, and that's part of the civility, as he kept noting that I'm up for a conversation. Let's talk about it, and not hammering down, this is what I want to have happen, and if you aren't with me, then I'll take care of your bills in file 13 and the like. And he's not saying anything like that.
Yeah. Operation Prairie Thunder, John, also delivered some numbers, which I have not checked into, so I'm really curious to hear your thoughts on what he said in the state address about Operation Prairie Thunder, acknowledging Brookings as being a flashpoint for their operations, but then also what kind of questions you have as a journalist when you look into what is the real impact of this operation.
That's perfect, Lori. The question is, he listed a certain number of arrests, drug arrests, DUIs, revoked licenses, and so forth. But the question is, would any of those have happened if they didn't have Operation Prairie Thunder? Mm-hmm. So is that an incremental number? It's just once you named this operation, these are all the things that have happened since then. So I think in large part, if it's all increment, in other words, if we've caught people who were driving under the influence who wouldn't have been caught otherwise, that's a good thing. And so is that worth the resources? Most citizens would say yes to do that. So I think, but it fits into the overall picture, I think, of this strong law enforcement, strong, crackdown on crime and so forth. So as a journalist, I would dig deeper and see, what really happened, where, is this, and I'd talk to the local folks to say, what do you see here? And if you're the police chief in Brookings, or if you are in other cities, maybe even the newspapers or whoever covers news in Brookings, and see what citizens are saying.
When we look, Dr. Card, at what's happening in Minnesota, and we look at Operation Prairie Thunder numbers and how it can appear, the political divides, the polarizations that we were talking about, what are some of the questions that you want to know about how this program is being executed in the state, especially when it comes to what South Dakotans feel about their strong support of law enforcement, but also a strong desire to be free from overreach of the government and to care about your neighbors?
And as well, to how do we keep our business community operating, because we have some problems, as was evidenced by a forum here in Sioux Falls, that we are having trouble finding agricultural workers. Mm-hmm. Our birth rates are relatively low relative to what we need for people like me who are retired and no longer in the working force. But milking cows is hard work. Sorting vegetables is hard work. A lot of the work is hard, and you can't make your margins necessarily by paying market level wages. So I think there's a lot of things that go into the South Dakota view of what immigration reform or trying to remove individuals who may be here unlawfully, at the same time that the federal government is dismantling the refugee system, is dismantling immigration judges, that they are, ICE is arresting people who are showing up to their regularly scheduled meeting with an immigration officer. It seems as though at one level we're shooting ourselves in the foot, and at the other level, there are people who have broken the law by being here unlawfully.
So my question is, we're watching the politics play out in a rather dramatic way, but is the policy progressing?
Well,
I think that's a good question.
Yeah, it is a great.
I would like to know more about the comprehensive immigration policy and how it is changing beyond the battle over specific operations in specific towns in South Dakota.
I think the biggest part of that, Lori, is that if you have policy or laws, and they are, there shouldn't be a question whether they are enforced or unenforced. And we have had in America for a long time. They'll say, "Yeah, these are the immigration laws, but we don't pay attention to them." And so there's it's a millions of people kind of dichotomy that's part of that. And so the question is, do you bring the laws to where you are in reality, or do you try to enforce the laws that are on the books? And all I can think of is that this focus on immigration laws could lead us to find place in the middle. I don't think it will under the current presidential administration. That's not kind of a place where they meet in the middle. But I'd love to see whatever the compromise is as far as immigration, come up with that, and then we'll say, okay, we all agree on this, and now we can mm-hmm. execute those laws. Right now, the law and practice are just so far apart. I don't know what you do.
And the politics come into this because Minnesota is not even in the top 10 states percentage-wise of immigrants who are here without legal status relative to the population. Those happen to be mostly Republican states.
Politics and policy. Anything that you didn't hear in the speech that you would like to hear more of? Anything? Otherwise, we need to move on. You mentioned population decline, and we just have to talk about our chaste women because there is this this quotation, and it's a beautiful quotation in its full context of Peter Norbrook saying, I believe in South Dakota, in the fertility of her soil, the warmth of her sunshine, and the nurturing tenderness of her winter snows. I love nurturing tenderness of her. That might be. I don't know if I always think snow is nurturing and tender.
And we're pretty sure he's been in a blizzard or two.
I believe in the simple beauty of her rolling prairies and the more pretentious splendor of her western hills. I believe in her government and in her institutions of home and church and school. I believe in the sturdy, intelligent manhood of her sons and the chaste womanhood of her daughters. Why include that quotation? Because, you know.
You can think of it a lot of ways, one of which is he provided the full paragraph of the concluding sentence.
Yes. There's more. We could go on. There's more to the quote.
There is. Mm-hmm. And that's one explanation for why that was included. It may have been another explanation that we're not looking forward, we're looking backward. We're trying to look to make South Dakota great again, as opposed to make South Dakota great in a different way than it was before, because the world is different than it was before. Hmm. And for some of us, that's a good thing. For others of us, the challenges that we face. You know, I think of the quote that Kathleen Norris put in her book, Dakota, A Spiritual Geography, when she asked a friend what she thought the ideal future would look like, and her friend said, it'd be like we were in the 1950s again. Now, that was 1980 when that book was published, but that's a notion that many of us don't like change. Mm-hmm. We don't want any change. And there are others of us that are quite hopeful about the future, as well as want to recognize the past, that some good things happened, some things that weren't so good. But we seem to be wanting to whitewash the bad things that happened in the past and yet still hold those up as an ideal to aspire to.
Yeah. John?
I think it's nostalgia. I think that's what they're trying to paint. And again, the 1950s. But remember, that speech by Norbeck was 1919. And so I spent a little mm-hmm. time thinking about what South Dakota was like in 1919. And, you know, kind of a brand new state, right, within a generation or two of its founding. And, yes, proud of the schools and churches and institutions. They started from whole cloth. There's a lot of that, you know, maybe got carried away a little bit with kind of that's been men were men and women were women or whatever.
Well, the children were above average.
Right. But I think it's a little bit of that. You know, things weren't perfect in 1919. We had the Spanish flu and we had other such problems. But
and I think Larry, farm problems.
Yeah. Well, and Larry, too, from being a rancher in western South Dakota, has seen the beauty of the rolling prairies and the hills and the sunsets and all that kind of stuff. So I think it appeals a little bit to him, too. So I think it's just a nostalgic moment, at least a little bit. And yes, I think, as Mike said, maybe looking back, let's do it the way we used to. And that is I don't think you can go back to four farm families on every section and the yellow school bus going down the street and picking up all the children. So it's a different world, and I think we do. But I think, you know, to end on in the nostalgic note, and maybe it's inspiring to some people. And you know, we believe in South Dakota. I love South Dakota, and I appreciate the passion toward the state.
And there is a line about solving the perplexing problems of the future as they have of those in the past. So let's talk about the future a little bit in our remaining time here. What are some of the things about the future and about his opportunity agenda that you think he is pushing at this point? There's a real conversation to be had about economic development and what that looks like in South Dakota right now, as some of these ideals and ideas clash with each other. What are you looking for, John?
Well, I think, yeah, economic development, I think, has been the heart of South Dakota's agenda for 40 years or more, is that let's move from where we are to get better. And I think almost everyone agrees the state should play a role in that, whether it's recruiting businesses or helping with housing or childcare or whatever those kinds of things are. So I do appreciate the idea of his open for opportunity, and most of the things that Larry has gone to in the recent months have been successes on economic development, either research or new jobs or whatever those kind of things are. But boy, that world has changed. When we started this 40 years ago with Mickelson, you'd loan a company money so that they could buy land and build a plant and have light assembly. And that kind of isn't there. You have the huge Swans thing, but then you have, what do you do in the small communities? What do you do for small business? What do you do for Main Street, small town South Dakota? We aren't recruiting jobs anymore because we have too many jobs, or we don't have enough people for the jobs.
Unemployment is low, yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. So you have that world changes all the time. So I hope our state continues to be flexible and move to different things. And, certainly, cybersecurity and artificial intelligence and all the things of maybe
and
of the
national
future.
National security.
Yeah. National security. And I think it's a nice emphasis, I think, that for South Dakota. Of course, cybersecurity in Madison is, we talk about it all the time. So we're eager to protect the nation in that sense.
Do you think that we're going to be as excited about national security and bomb building as we are about cybersecurity?
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't be as excited. What the collective we?
Drone munitions. We're talking about munitions.
Right. Yes. Is that the three of us or all of South Dakota is going to be excited?
I mean, is South Dakota, that's a real rally around the flag effort, or it could be a really complicated.
Well, what was it like when we were building missile silos?
Exactly. That's what I'm asking.
I don't know what it was like. Mm-hmm. I'm not
How
old
does
enough.
That land with South Dakotans?
But
I just remember getting the talk about what to do if you saw the flash, and crawl underneath your desk, because we were still 70 miles away from the nearest missile silo in north central South Dakota. But it was a very real thing about national defense.
In those films, there were no adults in the film. There's like a whole study on the fact that when they filmed those, there were no adults, and how an entire generation of children internalize this idea that when the bomb dropped, there would not be any adults in the room.
No kidding.
I heard it on NPR.
I'd love to hear the study.
How that impacted the baby boom generation, when they came of age. I find that fascinating.
I'm cleaning out my mom's house, and I just emptied the cabinet that kept all our bomb shelter supplies. Yep. So we had powdered milk and fresh water. I chose not to drink the water. It's been there for 60 years.
Probably a good plan.
So
good decision making. Yeah.
Yes.
Underneath the basement stairs, there was enough food to feed us for several months, and jugs of water in glass bottles. And, it was my mother who gave us the talk about what to do for radiation sickness and things of that nature.
Wow.
She was a school nurse.
But your question is valid, Lori. And what are we going to think about the future, whether it's drone munitions or, yeah. I mean, so
the future,
far, the,
yeah.
so far
data
the bomber
centers and drone munitions. These are the questions of the future. This is not the rolling hills and the splendor of the pretentious splendor of West River.
the expansion of Ellsworth in national defense.
This is a modern world that we live in. John Hunter is publisher emeritus of the Madison Daily Leader. He's a member of the South Dakota Newspaper Hall of Fame. Michael Cart is professor emeritus of political science at the University of South Dakota in Vermilion. You can find all our Dakota Political Junkies analysis on our podcast. Find the SDPB Dakota Political Junkies podcast on your favorite podcast platform. SDPB is your source for live, on-demand, and digital coverage of the 101st legislative session. All coverage can be found online at sdpb.org/sdnetwork. And that's our show for today. We hope that it served you. SDPB's news director is Josh Chilson. Our director of journalism is Kara Hetland. Thanks to Jackie Hendry, CJ Keene, and Jackson Dirks for their assistance in producing today's show. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.